color of disaster, race, class, and Hurricane Katrina. On this panel this afternoon, we have three heavy hitters to help us make sense of history and racial politics and the politics of landscape and space in the city of New Orleans, and to help shed some light on how this has affected the impact of Katrina and the way in which human political events actually caused so much of the devastation in the wake of that hurricane. So they're going to be speaking, beginning on the far end of the table, with Walter Johnson, director of NYU's American Studies program, and is also the author of Soul by Soul, Life Inside the Antebellum Slave Market, which focuses a great deal on the city of New Orleans, which won the Frederick Jackson Turner Prize of the Organization of American Historians. He's also editor of The Chattel Principle, Internal Slave Trades in the Americas. His latest project is a history of the Mississippi Valley that places U.S. slavery in the context of the histories of global capitalism and U.S. imperialism. Speaking next in the middle is my colleague Adam Green, who is director of graduate studies for NYU's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. His recent publications include Time Longer Than Rope, A Century of African-American Activism, 1850 to 1950, a volume he co-edited with Charles Payne, and the forthcoming, we're all very excited, Selling the Race, Culture and Community in Black Chicago, 1940 to 1955. And then finally, directly next to me, we have the distinguished George Lipsitz, professor of Black Studies and Sociology, now at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His recent publications include American Studies in a Moment of Danger, a provocative book about the changes in culture, social movements, and the state, prompted by the increasing power of transnational capital. He's also the author of a long list of highly regarded works. I'm one of the ones that we assign the most frequently in our classes here at NYU is The Possessive Investment in Whiteness, How White People Profit from Identity Politics, which is a look at the way that race determines life chances and structures experience in the United States. So we'll be starting Walter Adam George.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you for organizing this. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me. It's extremely humbling to stand up here and try and address the enormity of this event with the tool of my trade, which are words that seem very, 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 very slender in this moment. And it's also humbling to share both this platform and this stage generally with people of so much experience and wisdom. So you'll have to bear with me about the meagerness of this. What I have are three different pieces, sort of fragments of thought that I've written at various times over the past 3 weeks. I guess a little bit longer than that, over the past 5 weeks. And so I'm going to read each one with the date, and I'll just start with September 6th, 2005. New Orleans Director of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff tells us has been secured. We are reassured that law and order have triumphed over what the media have uniformly been referring to as lawlessness. These seemingly common sense formulations suggest that it was the absence of functioning civil authority, the absence of law, that resulted in the terrible scenes run in an endless loop on our television screens. Because New Orleans is the way that it is, largely poor and largely black, these words and images have symbolically identified African Americans with that state of lawlessness, or in its rougher-edged incarnation, savagery. I suppose that what lies behind these efforts to distinguish what has been happening in New Orleans from the ordinary conditions of civilization in the United States is a sense of uncomprehending amazement. It is hard for many to believe that black people might act in their own defense and attempt to affect their own survival in the face of their near total abandonment. And behind that empathetic stupefaction lies the idea that the citizens of New Orleans should have behaved themselves in an orderly manner, assembled on the veranda of the Superdome and sat tight, like so many civil rights Negroes waiting for the U.S. government to bail them out. Here's the thing. They have been waiting for years, for decades, and the law hasn't done them any favors. They have been suffering not from lawlessness, but its opposite. Laws which have allowed corporations to loot their resources and destroy their environment. Laws which have plowed millions and millions of dollars into subsidizing the exodus of whites from the city of New Orleans. The oft-mentioned Pontchartrain Causeway was one such project, a huge federally funded corridor built so that white suburbanites could beat a retreat from the city as soon as they picked up their paycheck. Laws which have used the image of duck-hunting sportsmen as a justification for allowing an unscrupulous firearms industry to flood their city with handguns and assault weapons. Laws which have allowed property to go untaxed and schools unfunded. Laws which have left their children vulnerable to police violence and harassment even as their elders go unprotected. Laws which have steered resources away from a levee system that everyone always knew was inadequate, and toward a war that everyone always knew was unnecessary. Laws which herded them into ill-equipped, quote, shelters and kept them confined there for fear that they might use the intact and fully functional US 90 bridge to cross over to the West Bank. Laws that left them to die on putrid sidewalks strewn with their own waste. To say that the disaster that has befallen New Orleans has been decades in the making is to slightly misstate the case. This disaster has been ongoing for decades, chronically rather than acutely, out of the sight of the spectacle-driven media. These people have been abandoned long before Hurricane Katrina, long before their piteous, undignified, nationally televised deaths forced us all to see the sneer behind the slogans, senior citizen, pro-life, no child left behind, homeland security. October 7th. 2005. For a lot of Americans, the city of New Orleans and the rest of the Gulf Coast represent the past. There are two parts to this identification of a place with a time. There is the Creole gentility and old-time jazz past identified with the French Quarter, and there is the violent, racist, pre-civil rights past that the South, no matter how many aging Klansmen murderers are jailed, is never seen quite to have left behind. Interestingly, it is the second of these notions, the more historical, less nostalgic version that George Bush, at least the scripted George Bush, has been using when he talks about New Orleans. He speaks of, quote, the legacy of racism and of poverty that has its, quote, roots in racial discrimination. This is taken by the media and even some on the left to be evidence of progress. The fact that the President of the United States would recognize that a great American city has been washed off the map and that the disaster had something to do with racism. But I'd argue that there is something more complicated and insidious going on in Bush's race rhetoric. Bush continually alludes to the history of slavery and racism in the United States as an aspect of the past, as something that the United States has left behind. And those references are always of a very specific sort. In his first inaugural address, for instance, Bush described the history of the United States as being that of, quote, a nation of slaveholders that became a servant of freedom. And in the speech he made on Gory Island 2 years ago, he likewise referred to the role of African and African-American slaves played in redeeming the sins of American slaveholders. Through their struggles against injustice, he explained, the very people traded into slavery helped to set America free. In Bush's telling, the history of slavery and racism always exists at one step of historical remove. They are aspects of the American past in which the historical advancement of freedom is paradoxically made obvious. They are the exceptions that prove the rule. The past, which has been transcended by the present. And for Bush, this conscription of the history of slavery and racism to a redemptive story about the history of American freedom has a biblical antecedent in Isaiah 53, which recounts the history of, quote, the suffering servant in amazing dialectical terms like this. He was wounded for our transgressions and bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. And this, for he was cut off from the land of the living, For the transgressions of my people, he was stricken. It is in black suffering that the United States has been redeemed, set free to spread the gospel of American freedom, as Bush said on Gory Island, in working the history of slavery into a justification for imperialism wherever the sun shines. But of course, thousands of people forcibly confined in a flooded city without anything to eat or drink is not evidence of the legacy of racism. It is racism. Or perhaps even more pointedly, it is race. It is evidence of the embodied condition of hypervulnerability that characterizes black life in the United States. And that condition, I would argue, is one that defies the easy separation of past and present that frames Bush's processional history from slavery to freedom and racism to poverty, which, of course, in Bush's view, is a moral condition rather than a historical one. One of the most striking things that I heard during the disaster was an interview with a woman who had been trapped inside the convention center, who, when asked what she had thought was going to happen, responded that she expected that the floodgates protecting the downtown area from the Mississippi River were going to be opened and that they were all going to be drowned. This is a racial common sense born of a history that has not flowed according to the landmark of progress suggested by Bush's slavery to freedom narrative, but instead according to a set of repetitions and surrogations, 1927, 1965, 2005, always these levees are breached and the others are not. Always the whites escape and the blacks are left to die. The living present memory of this history of racism, the sedimentation of countless violations into a sort of common sense account of what is possible and what is impossible in the United States of America, this seems to me to be less a legacy of past racism seeping into the present than of the fact that it doesn't make sense to divide history in these terms when the same things keep happening to black people over and over again. Jesse Jackson captured this ever-presence when he referred to the stifling squalor of the convention center as, quote, a slave ship. Jackson thus described a world in which the historical markers used by Bush to segment time do not apply. Where Bush's history describes a past defined by slavery and a present defined by the incompletely transcended legacy of the past, a present that is in which the condition of the city of New Orleans is seen as somehow anomalous, a spatially bounded lag in the progressive time of American freedom, Jackson describes a present that is indistinguishable from the past, a single centuries-long moment that is the history of the slave ship. Jackson's invocation of the history of slavery to describe the condition of African Americans in the 21st century calls upon us, I think, to frame our thinking about New Orleans around the question of reparations. Rather than accepting the idea that we are living at a moment characterized by the final chapter in the unfolding set story of freedom, the theorists and grassroots activists of reparations movement insist upon the presence of slavery in both its historical guise and in more contemporary forms of exploitation, disadvantage, and overprivilege, the presence of slavery, that is, in the contemporary condition of blackness. In its various articulations, the argument for reparations contests the symbolic subordination of slavery to freedom by making the case that slavery remains a living presence in the lives of African Americans. It thus represents what you might call a counter-history of the United States, one in which the narrative markers which underwrite an account of American history as a progression towards a supposedly just society in which we live today are replaced with images of temporal lags, the notion that the succession of slavery has been incomplete, or even of temporal stasis, the idea of American history as a single episode in a centuries-long black Holocaust. Jackson, I think, calls upon us to recognize in New Orleans not simply an image of the United States past, but of its present and its future, a world without environmental and labor protection, a world where white people have huge iron fences around their houses and black people live behind bars, a world where white flight and capital flight have left young black people with a poisoned choice between lives in the military or lives in the supermax, a world in which plaid skirts, standardized tests, and, quote, intelligent design are promoted as solutions for schools where students are lucky if they can find a flushing toilet. A world in which the suffering of the slave has not been redeemed by the promise of freedom, but instead remains a daily presence in lives lived along the rough edge of racial time. October 14th, 2005, 11:59 p.m. 2 weeks ago, the New York Times ran a full-page advertisement under the heading, quote, "Another Victim of the Iraq War." Did anybody see this? The photo was of a black man lying dead, face down in about 8 inches of water. He appeared to have been a middle-sized man and a middle-aged man, casually dressed, lying there in 8 inches of water with his white-socked, shoeless feet representing the tragic, lonely overexposure of his passing. This seemed to me to be an extraordinary advertisement. It made a connection that many of us have wanted to make between the war in Iraq and the disaster in New Orleans. It bespoke the disinvestment in America that has underwritten American adventurism abroad, and suggested the pattern of bungles and excuses that have defined the Bush administration, the endless appeal to the mysteries of epistemology. Nobody could have possibly known for sure that, fill in the blank, that have come to stand in for responsible governance and accountability. And it did so in visual terms almost without precedent in the mainstream American media, in which the images of dead bodies are almost routinely censored, euphemized, marginalized, and contained within a visual code designed, I suppose, to keep the delicate sensibilities of American viewers from coming into contact with the carnage inflicted on the rest of the world in the name of defending, well, delicate sensibilities. The sight of dead American bodies is routinely treated, that is to say, as an obscenity. Unless, of course, those bodies are brown or black. The same day's newspaper had on its cover a story about the members of the 82nd Airborne who have been delegated to deal with shipping the remains and possessions of dead soldiers home from Iraq. This article, too, had a photo of a couple of soldiers moving casket-sized boxes which were described as containing the soldiers' property onto an airplane. And this helped me see what more clearly what was in stake in the conscription of this photo of this poor dead black man to the cause of critiquing the war in Iraq. The well-grooved connection of the representation of suffering with the representation of blackness, the fact that black bodies serve as a sort of immediate visual code for human suffering, made it possible to use the image of a dead black man in New Orleans to represent the war in Iraq. The photo sent the message that we had finally caught the Bushies out, that all the lies that they had told, all of the hidden torture, the disappeared detainees, the uncounted Iraqi dead, and the unrepresentable American dead would finally float back to the surface in the flood. And that is what I find so disturbing about it. The hypervisibility of black suffering serves here as a sort of universal substitute for all of the other unrepresentable victims of U.S. imperialism. Indeed, in that man's death is forecast a sort of redemption. The representation of his punishment serves to mark and thus to begin the process of redeeming the sins of the United States of America. This image of the flood, that is to say, is no less than Bush's use of Isaiah framed by a biblical story of sin, punishment, and redemption in which black suffering is redemptive of American freedom. And as powerful as this image is, and as many important, palpable, material connections between the war in Iraq and the disaster in New Orleans might be made through its display under this heading, I think that it also represents a sort of dispossession, the conscription of the dead of New Orleans to the cause of opposing the war in Iraq. I say this not because I believe that there are no connections to be made between the two, but because I believe that the moral enormity of the war in Iraq is such that it has the power to frame its own opposition, to narrow and transform politics on the left from a politics that are genuinely and broadly anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist into a politics that are defined by opposition to this war in this place, to a politics which have been misleadingly framed around a specific manifestation of what is actually a much broader structure of racial and imperial violence, and which have been correspondingly diminished. And that is what seems to me to be happening when that heading is used as an epitaph. The ground of politics on which the image of this man's dead body is defined by opposition to one manifestation of the bloody knotted history of American racism, capitalism, and imperialism, the war in Iraq, rather than as a simultaneous instance of that larger set of depredations with its own specific pathos and gravity. Indeed, I would say that the hypervisibility of black suffering that we have seen in New Orleans, this slave-built city, foremost among the continent's markets in human flesh, might remind us of a broader, more critical politics, a global politics defined by its opposition to what Jesse Jackson termed the slave ship as much as to the war machine.
Speaking next is Adam Green.
Thank you to Lisa Dugan, Tricia Rose, Sheila Cabaldo, who's probably not here, the outreach coordinator for Department of Social and Cultural Analysis, the students that have been volunteering to put this together, that this has come together in a short amount of time and it's already been such a wonderful event is something that's a real testament to your efforts, and I want to applaud you. I want also to thank my fellow participants and audience participants. And I also don't know if Carlita Moore is still here from Community Labor United. I don't think she is. I'd actually wanted to recognize her too. The announcement of the People's Hurricane Fund by Community Labor United back in early September essentially was the inspiration for what I'm going to offer today in the form of remarks, as will soon become clear. I should maybe apologize in the sense that I feel like I'm a bit out of step in terms of the panel, but I think ultimately what's going to come out of it is probably going to be useful discussion, and that I feel like the remarks that I'm about to give in particular resonate a lot with what was brought up by Brenda Marie Osby and Michaela Harrison in the last panel, and I imagine some things that will come up in the next panel, but hopefully it will all come together as a good mix. There are a number of different themes, of course, that have organized what we have seen and what we have heard in relation to the events of the past month in Louisiana, New Orleans, and the Gulf Coast. The stories of tragic loss, such as the ones that we heard earlier this morning and to some extent last night, suffered by the people of Louisiana and Mississippi. Stories of diverse and atrocious actions on the part of federal, military, state, and yes, local authorities, which hampered recovery, continue to hamper recovery, and cause numerous unnecessary deaths. And also those stories of the restorative and rich inventory of the richness of black cultural heritage on the Gulf Coast and in particular in New Orleans. And this last one has been striking to me because in some sense I feel like what has been a platform for trying to imagine a series of actions that we can take in support and perhaps even from a point of initiative around how to intervene in this situation have been largely about affirming the sense of heritage. And I mean this heritage not just in artistic terms, but also in a very broad sense in terms of the arts of living. Many profound examples of this, of course, we've already seen last night and today, and we'll see in the next panel, from Second Lines to Gumbo to Shotgun Shacks. And of course, they have multiple lines of origin that we need to inventory and appreciate. I'm struck in particular, for instance, by historian Gwendolyn Midloe Hall's characterization of New Orleans as indisputably the most African city in the United States, the product of century-long creolizing, and creolizing here, I think, means exactly what Brenda Osby was speaking about, a process of blackening as opposed to a process of hybridizing. Creolizing interplay of Caribbean transplants, transported and resold slave peoples, and the singular instability of white political, social, and cultural authority well into the 19th century within New Orleans, which offered the needed room for black worldviews to structure public life in a way as we see in no other major community in this country. Within a few days of Katrina, however, and in the face of a blitz of callous news reports, and I want to sort of acknowledge and also pay tribute to Tony Zambrano for pulling that footage and telling the stories that he did in relation to conveying some of the atrocious truths that were present in New Orleans. But at the same time, I think we have to acknowledge in terms of looking at the media, and it's probably something that will certainly come up in discussion, the extraordinary level of disinformation that came out early in the story, I think a little bit less so after the first week flew to a close, and I think in some ways is picking up again and has picked up again over the past couple of weeks. Stories which largely represent the couple hundred thousand of those who remained in New Orleans, mostly black, mostly poor, as clueless and hopeless. As I saw these stories, and this was during the first week, I came to believe that in terms of thinking about this sense of a kind of cultural resilience among those in New Orleans, and particularly the black and the poor, that one of the fundamental sources of this did not even go back to this question of a kind of African sense of origins or some kind of context that needed to be elaborated in a kind of more profound way, that it was a very simple and basic truth, that New Orleans, more so than any city, is the place where black people stay and where they have made and continue to make their home. And in saying that, I'm trying to speak about the ways in which making a home is not a casual, not an incidental, not an ordinary set of actions, but a profound set of actions, maybe the most profound set of actions that people can do. And again, I think that what's been brought up, particularly by Ms. Osby, really underscores this. New Orleans, after all, of all the major cities in the United States, is the place where children of parents who grew up in that city stay in that city far more so, at a far higher rate, than any place else in the country. The sense of intergenerationality, in terms of the ways in which people gather knowledge, carry knowledge, and pass it on again and again and again over time, sometimes two, three centuries through, again, not to kind of belabor the point, as Ms. Osby's own story illustrates, that this is something that really represents a profound birthright and a profound resource, and something which tells us, I think, about the extraordinary stakes in terms of just what kind of direction New Orleans takes in relation to its rebuilding. The various calls that have been made at different moments over the course of our discussions thus far to first and foremost guarantee that the rebuilding of New Orleans, the revitalization of New Orleans, is something that's popularly accessed, is something that's broadly shared, is something that public and large groups of people, especially those that are displaced, play a major role in being able to do, I think is underscored by understanding that all of the kinds of extraordinary wealths that we see in New Orleans, many of which derive directly from this kind of sense of heritage that I'm speaking about in terms of black history, black life, black cultural folkways, go back fundamentally to the very active and very profound ways that black people have made home there. So in looking at this, I'm really trying also to put a lie to the legend of New Orleans as the Big Easy, a latter-day entrepot, living for drunk conventioneers, beads and doubloons, and girl gone wild videos, which in mildly sanitized form represents precisely the future brand identity of the ideally rebuilt city imagined by developers, neoliberal local elites, and privatizing feds. New Orleans' strength, for myself and I'm sure for others, myself being one who has visited only briefly but indelibly, is fundamentally the opposite of this. Home ground, not Sin City, an essentially black town of dense networks of association and kin, rather than a casual destination for the young, the white, and the materially secure. So in all sorts of ways, then, the true rebuilding of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast begins with what the Community Labor United group called, quote, the most fundamental demand of their People's Hurricane Relief Fund document. And again, I quote, the right of the people of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast to return to their homes and participate in reconstruction. And in thinking about what's at stake in terms of trying to empower this call and assist in making this call happen and coming behind the leadership of people displaced themselves who are going to do the work of rebuilding that city, we have to grasp the scope and the enormity of the problem that presently exists. In some ways, I think the atrocity that follows the atrocity of the first week, which is all of the ways passively and actively that people are being kept away from doing that work of reclaiming their city and remaking their homes. At present, there are 600,000 or more families displaced due to Hurricane Katrina and the related collapses of local infrastructure in New Orleans and elsewhere along the Gulf Coast region. I think one important contextual frame to think about in terms of trying to get your head around what that figure means is to compare it, for example, to the precedent of migrations of African Americans during the 20th century. Ms. Osby brought up the late 19th century exodus, largely of middle-class and upper-middle-class African Americans trying to escape New Orleans and other southern cities in the wake of the emergence of Jim Crow laws and Jim Crow custom. But of course, many millions more, over 6 million, left various parts of the South to move to the North in two primary waves from 1915 to 1930, from the early 1940s until the early 1970s. But bear in mind, during any one year, no more than 200,000 or 300,000 people were leaving. We are talking about 300,000 or more African Americans leaving New Orleans, to say nothing of the Mississippi region, to say nothing of other parts of Louisiana, in the space of a week. And what has happened to these people as a result of having been dispersed, having been put on the move, as a result of all of the different decisions, all of the different missteps that resulted in the collapse of the city that they live in? For the most part, after shelters, they find themselves now either being moved over to large FEMA-style shelters in the form of trailer parks. Originally, the plans were having 25,000 trailers in single units spread apart in various parts of the South that would doubtless create even worse conditions than the very sort of lowest in terms of economic and material condition of them had faced when they were in New Orleans. Or, just recently, as a story from The Time indicated, the vast majority, in fact, of those people that have been resettled have been put into hotel rooms, which may sound like a nice deal in relation to not having had access to showers, working sanitary facilities, various kinds of other facilities around privacy and the such. But the fact that people are being moved around in this sort of haphazard, willy-nilly way without any capacity to maintain in touch with each other, without any capacity to recombine or reconnect with family members in many cases, the call that the People's Hurricane Fund has made for the lists of survivors who are housed in various parts of the country to be made public, that are housed with FEMA and the American Red Cross, strikes me as absolutely fundamental in relation to this situation. And going back again to the ways in which this interconnectedness, this intergenerationality, this deep sense of community that was centered in places in New Orleans represents the single most important cultural, social, collective resource that people have there, and the single most important aspect of what's going to be a meaningful reconstitution of New Orleans as a community. The fact that people are dispersed in this sort of way all across the country, dispersed under conditions where they have no sense necessarily of where they're going to be living a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year from now, and basically no easy access to the kinds of funds and resources that make it possible for them to come up with a plan themselves, either for resettlement or eventually for return to New Orleans. This, it seems to me, is a fundamental scandal, a fundamental atrocity on top of the other atrocities that have taken place thus far in relation to the ways in which people have been treated leaving New Orleans. It's something that has to be called for in relation to remedy. So, as things stand right now, the kinds of relief programs that have been put in place that cover essentially not so much for a kind of failed or bumbling government, but instead, and I think it has to be said in terms of looking at the federal response, for what could be seen as conservative adventures in new governance, calling for school vouchers, proposing shelter and funding shelter rather than providing and enabling residents. The decision, for instance, of the Bush administration to not allow relief funds in relation to Katrina to go through the Section 8 program, which generally allows for more long-term resettlement, more long-term choices on the part of individuals seeking assistance with housing, and instead channeling those funds through FEMA, where people unfamiliar with the workings of this organization, and after what we've seen over the past 6 weeks, who could possibly be familiar with the way in which this organization works? That this kind of move is not a sort of accident, it's not a move that's trying to sort of convey some sense of not having an ideological or government agenda. In fact, very specifically, it's trying to push a very different model and a much more threatening model of governance. even militarized public space in the ways in which, of course, not only New Orleans, but most of these shelters and doubtless these FEMA areas, when they're eventually restaged and turned into resettlement areas, are going to be regulated by military and armed personnel. All of this, I think, is evidence of the ways in which this is not an accident in terms of the kinds of decisions that have been made in terms of policy, but experiments in very deliberate and very ambitious, from a white rightward point of view, public policies. This kind of complex, the desire to retain private control over rebuilding New Orleans, the dispersal of hundreds of thousands of displaced people itself as an event, makes the kind of question of reconstituting the community that I was speaking about before, finding ways to empower those leaving Black New Orleans, those leaving the Black Gulf Coast, to make their home again, all the more difficult. And yet, I think that this really has to be the place, when we think about different kinds of proposals and different kinds of agendas, where our efforts all channel into. Not so much thinking about how to create the most effective, the most acute, the most profound critique, but finding ways to fall in line behind the leadership of the people themselves who are going to be leading this effort to reconstruct their homes, reconstruct their communities, reconstruct, hopefully, this country. And so, with that in mind, I simply want to say that, to my mind, in terms of thinking about what we take out of this and what we take out of this event, at the same time that we protest, at the same time that we deeply reject the kinds of abuses that have taken place, I really think that it is very, very important that we not only acknowledge the organizing efforts of individuals who are working hard to come up with credible plans around here, but fall in line behind those efforts and figure out ways to assist that work. Thank you.